Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to have a quick intro, then afterwards we're going to talk about alternate formats of Game of Thrones play, and then we're going to answer some questions from listeners.
Welcome to episode 12, and listeners may notice that my voice is doing a few strange things. So I'm now recording on a brand new rig. I'm very excited. It was a lot of fun to put together, and man, has that gotten easier in the last 5 or 6 years. So many luxury features on these cases. I didn't even cut myself once.
But it's done a lot of strange things to his voice.
Exactly.
So if he sounds sexier than normal, that's because of my editing.
John spent the last 10 minutes complaining because he's been editing one of the segments, and there's static all over it because of the way this is set up. So it may take us a week or so to finally get this lined up. Hopefully you guys get the wonderful end product after John's hard work.
But till then, Alex is going to sound very sultry.
Sultry? I like that.
Well, because you have a deeper voice as I lower the bass.
Oh, I add a filter to it anyway in post-production, so
oh, wow.
Maybe I won't have to. News for this week. One of the biggest items that I wanted to touch on was that 2C1C released their 200th episode, their bicentennial episode.
And that's absolutely amazing. It's a ton of work to do a podcast. I mean, Alex does a lot of the work on our side, but Kenan does a lot of the work for 2C1C, and he's really the host that's been there the whole time. So, I mean, good on him and good on the whole cast.
Yeah, I had never listened to a podcast prior to listening to 2C1C. There is no way that Beyond the Wall would have exist in its current form or that I would be a part of it if it weren't for 2C1C. So I definitely owe them that. But in that episode, they also did spoil 3 of the Barrow cards from House of Talons, and Team Covenant also spoiled both Lannister cards from House of Talons, and we spoiled all 3 Greyjoy cards last week. I think we're down to 14 out of 20 cards now officially known.
Which is crazy, because I hear it's already shipping, too, so we're going to see the whole chapter pack in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, they really moved fast on that. I think the impression I get is that the last chapter pack was delayed, which we kind of knew, and that this one won't be, so they'll be quite close together. But I was initially thinking, you know, they gave us 3 spoilers, this is great, we can release one a week. But I'm glad we didn't. We'd have been behind on the chapter pack release.
Yeah, we'd be releasing the last spoiler and the pack would already be out.
There is another item of news. We don't generally talk about the TV show, but as of today, there's fairly big news involved in the HBO Game of Thrones show.
4 out of the first 10 episodes have been spoiled.
I don't know about spoiled. That's not the word I would use. Leaked. Leaked.
Released
possibly,
ahead of time? Leaked? Sure.
My understanding is that it's the first 4 episodes were given out as screen copies to reviewers and things like that, and that it came from one of those, and that it still has like HBO watermarks and things like that in the image. I'm not going to bother because I won't have a chance to listen to the first episode till Tuesday anyway, so I don't have time for more than one a week. This doesn't affect me at all, but I don't like this sort of thing happening.
I don't like it either. I mean, the older I get, the more I realize how much hard work and cost goes into these shows. And I literally subscribe to HBO every year around this time to ensure I can watch Game of Thrones. And I do that because I want to support the people that are making the show. So to me, downloading it sucks.
Yeah, and there are lots of other reasons. You know, initially you could only get it with a cable package, and you know, it was expensive, and you know, okay, you'll buy the DVD. But now HBO was just pushing their new HBO Now, I think it's called, where they're trying to make it more accessible and easier for people who say, look, I really want to watch it legally, you know, sort of like Steam for video games. I want to buy these things legally. I want to do it conveniently and more conveniently than pirating, and I'm willing to pay. And now the first 4 episodes are, you know, that's really got to hit their bottom line.
Yeah, that sucks big time for them. I mean, like you said, HBO Now was going to be pretty cheap. They had a gift certificate here in Ottawa where it was like $8 a month for the first 6 months to watch Game of Thrones and a bunch of the other big shows. Like, it's not their full product line, but pretty close. And it's sad to see that, you know, this leak is probably going to affect that in a negative way.
I want to encourage the idea of making things readily available like this, of this HBO Now. I think it's a great idea. I think it follows in many other good anti-piracy techniques of making things available legally and easy, you know, none of this complicated stuff. And if their bottom line takes a lot of a hit, they might just think that this Now idea is a bad idea. So I'm not saying go out and buy it, but I'm saying I have.
I have as well.
And aside from that, the episode runs a little bit long, but before we jump into it, I did want to, John, if you could maybe explain, because we have a new segment we haven't done before, and this was entirely your idea.
Well, I get a lot of questions from new players, and I'm always happy to answer them, and Alex gets a bunch of questions from new players as well, and old players alike, and we like to answer them. So this week I wasn't able to type them all out, so instead we answered a whole bunch on the show, and I think it went really well.
Yeah, the guest jumped right in, and I think we have a nice little new segment, so we will try and do that every once in a while. And if you want your name to appear in these segments, feel free to mention it. If you don't mention it, we won't put your name in it. So it doesn't matter how stupid the question is.
We'll just ask the question and not mention who asked. And that's what I did in this segment, because I didn't have time to contact everyone and ask them if it was okay.
And I guess without further ado, let's...
Well, welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. And today we're joined actually by, I think, an individual that holds a unique title in the Game of Thrones community. Dan, I believe you're the only person to have won a World Alternate Format Tournament in Game of Thrones. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if I'm the only one. I guess I have won one. And I think you and I played in the finals in that.
We did. Now, I mean, there was probably only 8 of us or something that day because it was on a Sunday after Joust and everyone was really tired. But I think officially that was the last alternate format Worlds event. And the year before that, I believe they actually had to call it quits because of time before a winner was announced. Now, if the winner is out there and wants to correct me on that, feel free to email us. But I believe right now, Dan is the only official Worlds champion of alternate format.
So was this back when Worlds was Gen Con, or was this Worlds at the FFG Center?
This was Worlds at Gen Con, and this was the first Worlds I ever played at.
You know, John, I hadn't realized that I could be the only person who have won an alternate format tournament. I feel like that's a resume item I'm missing out on.
At Worlds. There's been other alternate formats. They had a 2v2 in the UK. They've had team events at Shalik. They've had Kingsmoot as a side event at FFG. But this, I believe, was the only time they actually ran it as a full event, which was – it's kind of cool, Dan. I mean, congratulations. You're a world champion. You just didn't get a card designed for it.
I don't know. Does the draft count as an alternate format?
I guess now it does.
Because they did do it. They did run a draft. But I don't know if it was official.
No, they ran a whole bunch of side event drafts, right? They didn't run a single draft event.
That's right.
So Dan might be the only one.
That brings us to today's topic, which we're primarily going to be talking about alternate formats. I wanted to clarify, alternate formats, I don't really mean alternate tournament formats, because we've had to talk about that in the past. Things like the team format that was run by Ryan Jones in California. Things like the...
2v2.
Yeah, well, 2v2 might be an alternate format because you need some additional rules for it. But, you know, the triple elimination instead of Swiss rounds or different bracket systems, those are different ways to run your tournament, but you're still playing the same Joust game. But these are all variants.
So it's kind of cool that FFG actually has all these different alternate formats. And these are official alternate formats because when the box sets used to come out, they used to introduce a whole new way of playing the game. And the one I played Dan in was actually Hand of the King, where you have a character that comes, gets gold tokens, and once it reaches its gold value, comes into play. And it can never really be killed. Once it dies, it actually goes back into this place where it gains gold tokens again and comes back into play. So it allows you to build your deck around this powerful character in some cases. It was a lot of fun. Did you enjoy it, Dan?
I did, yeah. That was the year that I played Targ the Maester's Path. Actually, and I'm sure people are rolling their eyes as they're listening to Targ Maester Path, but that was before the draw chain had come out. And I think at that time there were only four chains.
This was Killer of the Wounded deck then, right?
Yes, yeah. This was the deck where I loaded up Killer of the Wounded. And at that time, he was not errated so that he could use his ability an infinite number of times. And on a threat round, you could just load him up with Lead Link and a couple other chains. And then every time you use a Lead Link, he'd stand up so that you could discard somebody's board, usually by marshaling phase. It worked great with the Hand of the King because with all of the attachments I was playing, it made it very easy to play the Targaryen King Viserys that reduced the win condition, or the number of power needed to win for each chain he had on him. And plus, he was only one, so he was very easy to get in and out if he died.
I guess starting with the Hand of the King variant, which box set did that come up with?
This came out, I think, we were right in the middle of the Maester cycle, so would that have
been... That must have been Targ then, right?
Targaryen? Yeah, I think it was Targaryen.
You mentioned that you have a character that starts out of play, you put a gold token on them every round, and then once they have enough gold tokens equal to their cost, they come into play, they can't be killed, but they can remove gold tokens, so they'll leave play and come back into play. That's the essence of it,
exactly.
Right? But the win condition changes a little bit?
Right, because you can't actually win unless your Hand of the King is in play and filled with go tokens up to his cost. Which is interesting, too. But some people use very powerful characters. Like, I chose Bran so that I could... Because at the time, there was no limit on Bran, and I could cycle plots like a mad fiend. And I played a Stark Shadows deck or something janky like that.
The other thing that made that Targaryen deck good was that if you read the rules, you'll notice rather than the character dying, you can remove a gold token to effectively save that Hand of the King. However, with Targ Burn, it doesn't work that way because once I drop Threat from the North, I can burn someone and they can't really be saved. They just lose all of their coins. So it was quite effective. Just burn in general was quite effective, and then the Killer of the Wounded combination in particular in that format.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So this would cause it to leave play, instead removes one gold token. So you strip all gold tokens from it?
I think so.
Yeah, that's how
that's
I
the
would
rate
it. Wow. That actually sounds kind of broken.
The alternate format was broken. Yeah.
So this is my actual favorite alternate format. I've played the others as well, but I always come back to this one. It might be because it was my first experience with the alternate format, so it burned in my subconscious. You know, I took second in a tournament, and I played against a great player, and blah, blah, blah. So, and we were actually being TO'd on that tournament by Nate, who was, like, really chatty and stuff, which was great, too.
Nate was really chatty. Good Lord.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that? I've never seen that. But again, remember, this was the night after, so everyone was kind of hungover and hurting. And but for me and Dan, who I guess didn't drink that much, but decided to play in the alternate format.
So what's the basic optimal strategy? You mentioned burn there, but is the idea that you should pick a low gold character so you can get them affecting the game early? Stand behind this invulnerability to get a high gold character in play.
Okay, some people were playing with characters that had a cool leave play effect. That were cheap and they would actually, you know, leave play and come back into play over and over again with this gold token thing. But I think that was too costly, and I think that's why they didn't go far, because if you have to put three gold onto Jorah, that's three plot phases that you have to wait before he's going to come back into play for his effect.
Well, no, because you only remove one gold token from him.
Right, but they were removing all the gold tokens through a burn effect.
Yeah. He'd go out of play. Then you have to wait another three rounds, right?
They'd get gold on him, and he'd come back in, and they use his into-play effect. So if you were using an into-play effect, it had to be a big effect and really strong. But I've seen people who didn't care how much power their opponent had. They just relied on killing their opponents, Hand of the King, over and over and over again, like a Bear Island deck, for instance, where they would just slay that king every time he came into play, and then would just keep the power counters below 15 for the turn that he would actually come back into play, and then kill him and put him back into play, out of play. Interesting, but dangerous.
Yeah, John, I recall our game was quite close. In fact, I think you were just one round away from winning. And I had played in that deck, both in the tournament version and in the alternate format version, one copy of Favorable Ground, which I held for, I think, two or three rounds, and was finally able to pull off on the critical round before you would have been able to come back and win. So that made it quite exciting.
It was kind of embittering because I was playing, like I said, Stark Shadows, so I had a lot of shadow locations in play to lock out my opponent. And when they all went away to a Favorable Ground, it kind of made me cry inside. And I believe I actually got to 15 power, but you had killed my Hand of the King, so it didn't matter, and then you swung back, and it was a good game.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So is this, especially given the current meta where Burn, for instance, has gotten more redundancy and things like that, is this format playable at a competitive level still? Or was it ever?
I think so, actually. I think you could build competitive decks for this for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, like with any format, it really just depends on the kind of metagame and what you expect. I would also say, I guess, that because the current restricted list is built around the existing rules for the current format, you might think about if you wanted to use a competitive or an alternate format as a competitive format, you'd probably have to think about a different restricted list. Just because, like what John said, there are certain cards that might be more powerful. I mean, I think about a card that goes in and out of play that might be immune to burn or would somehow get around that particular weakness could be quite strong if they're coming in and out and doing very powerful things while they enter or exit play.
But let's talk about the other formats, because there's actually a couple more that one of the big things in Ottawa actually is when new players first started, they really enjoyed a format where you use a single deck between all the participants. And in this format, everyone's drawing from the centralized deck, and it's basically an in-house war. Do you know the name of that format, Alex? Because I'm sure you know the specific name.
The in-house war that we mentioned in the cast about 10 minutes ago? Yeah, it's called Civil War, yeah. And it was released with the Martell set. I'm actually curious because I have played some Civil War games before. I've actually used it as a teaching tool as well. But when you guys have or have thought about Civil War, do you play it as a 1v1 or do you play it as a multiple player game?
I've done both. So I've played Civil War Melee and I've played Civil War Joust, and actually both formats are super well balanced because you're using the same deck. And the way we played the Joust was that each player brought a deck and you flip a coin, and then, you know, heads you use the other guy's deck or tails you use your own, so there wasn't an advantage with someone knowing the deck. But it's really hard to make a deck that's balanced that you and your opponent are both going to be using, because you don't want to put any bombs in there, right? Because if they draw the bomb and you don't, they can win the game with it. So you build a very generic vanilla deck, which puts the emphasis on player skill. So it's an interesting dynamic, in my opinion.
Now, do you let people bring their own plot decks? Because in the official rules, I think that it's 100 or so card deck for two people. You add 20 cards per person, but people bring their own plot decks.
Right, yeah. And because you're flipping a coin and you don't know who you're going to play, that can be an interesting dynamic as well with the plot decks. But yes, we let people bring their own plot decks.
See, I think that for me what makes this format a little... I initially thought that it would make such a great teaching tool because you're using many of the same cards as your opponent. So he gets to see how you're using some of this. Like, why are you playing Flea Bottom Scavenger? Why are you playing this? And, you know, and they get to see a little bit of that and play along with some of the same cards. But I've sort of ignored the deck building restrictions that they give of no more than 5 cards of the same type or no more than 1 copy of a unique. Even though it's flavorful, I feel that that makes the game more sporadic and you lose a little bit of that teaching opportunity of showing people how some of the cards that they probably have in hand are supposed to work.
Yeah, that would make sense to me. I mean, I understand that it'd be less for teaching, but I think it makes the format cooler.
Alex, I love your idea of using that format as a teaching tool. That's something I hadn't considered before. I've never really played the Civil War variant, kind of played around in a similar fashion, just taking test draws with friends, and we might play kind of half of a game, I guess, but never officially sanctioned or anything. The thing that I find really interesting or fun about alternate formats is that it forces you to look at cards in a different way. one card that may not have been as powerful before becomes extremely powerful, or another card that might have been perceived as very powerful or even meta-defining because it's part of a combo might no longer be as efficient. And that, for someone who enjoys deck building, is quite interesting.
It does. It breathes a new life into the way you look at cards, in the same way that Joust and Melee are alternate formats. They just happen to be the core formats of the game. But I look at Melee deck building as a completely different endeavor and completely different challenge than Joust gameplay.
Right. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and I think that creative juices that get flowing sometimes when you're building for these alternate formats can translate into Joust or Melee, because you stumble upon some of these cards that haven't been used in a really long time that you realize are really good now thanks to these alternate formats. And I think it's one of the good reasons to play these formats once in a while for fun with friends. And, you know, Game of Thrones is about fun in the end. It's because it can help you in the competitive
scene. I think what you said about cards that can be more powerful or less powerful, in fact, in Civil War, I'd say it's the opposite. I'd say you can use cards that suck. Cards you couldn't use otherwise.
Yeah, you want to use
because,
cards that suck.
Yeah, put in five or six of this card that's sort of mediocre, or 10 of them if you like, you know, and both of you will be playing with them, and you'll get to have a very different game dynamic without having made your deck worse, because it's the same deck your opponent is playing. So you can actually tune the power level to a slower game for teaching or a faster, higher stakes game, and you're the only one doing the deck building work, so you can bring that in. So again, I like it as a teaching tool.
I've seen people try to build really intricate, like complicated decks where they have a bunch of little combos because they hope that their opponent will catch on to it when they present their deck if they won the coin toss fast enough so that they could win with those combos before their opponent realizes, like, oh my goodness, I should have played that and that instead of this, because that's how you win with this deck. So I think it makes you think of deck building in a very unique way as well.
I guess that brings us to the third official format, which I suspect is the one that has been the least played. And part of that is because it's basically a 3-6 player only format, and when you have 3-6 players around and you want to try something different than what a lot of us are doing, you tend to play Melee, which is a very fun game and is probably better balanced than this. I've only played one Kingsmoot, and it was a landslide victory where one person grabbed like five titles and hit 15 power, because the titles were flipping back and forth, and it really felt like, sorry, not a landslide victory, but in that because you didn't have the title restrictions of supporting and opposing, the game was so wide open, it was so unstable, that you never really got a feeling of table talk or anything like that. It was just pounding, and then eventually somebody emerged, and you're like, wow, they completely slaughtered everyone.
I love Melee. I played Kingsmoot twice, both times. I felt like there was one person at the table that everyone turned on and picked on, and they had no way to use, like you were saying, Alex, the titles to protect themselves for a round, to get back in the game. So I always felt like there was one player that was leaving the table extremely dissatisfied with the format. And because of that, I don't actually play it. I haven't played it since.
Yeah, I've never played that format. I've heard it's okay, but I think, like you, Alex, I feel if I'm going to play an alternate format, and if it's going to be a Melee format, then the alternate format to Joust is, I think, best for me if it's just the standard Melee format.
I think if they do try and release this kind of thing in the future, they have to keep that in mind. It is harder to get four people to play the game or six people to play the game, and I tend to take any time that I have that opportunity to play Melee, which I love.
Yeah, and as bad as Melee can be at the competitive scene, I mean, it can be a lot of fun, but it can also be quite frustrating. It's a blast with friends. Just the standard Melee format is just a ton of fun.
I know a bunch of people that play only Melee. They don't play competitively at all, but they just play Melee, and it's great. It's so much fun with them.
There have been historical alternate formats with different card pools and sort of Highlander legacy, like a sort of standard format back when there was a CCG transition. Do you guys know anything about those? I think Legacy Highlander was the format they introduced, right?
Yeah, I saw a Legacy Highlander game once, but I didn't know what was going on or the cards, so it was interesting. But there was about a dozen players that were playing it, because the first Gen Con that I attended was the last Gen Con that they had a side event. It wasn't an official event with the old card pool.
Yeah, I had a couple of Legacy decks for that format, actually, John. One of them was the old Baratheon agenda where you split your deck into two. Forget what it was called. And that deck could win on round one, unless it was slow, and then it would win on round
for
two.
For those listeners not familiar with it, because this is casting back to the CCG, the agenda allowed you to have two separate decks, each of 30 cards. You couldn't include neutrals, and most people had gamed it so they had one deck that they drew for their setup hand, which was nothing but good setup cards, and then another one that they drew for the game, right?
Yes, yeah, the second deck usually I used were just basically all events and tricks and standing effects. So you'd always have basically a 7-card setup, maybe a 6-card setup from time to time, but usually 7. And then you'd just be drawing into events.
That sounds really broken.
It does indeed. Even with the Highlander format. So the Highlander, the Legacy format allowed you to use CCG cards. And only CCG cards. The Highlander format meant that you could only have one of any given card?
Yeah, but the thing about it was, after, I guess, 5+ years of CCG cards, there were plenty, and a lot of redundancy in terms of actual effect, even if the names of the cards were different. So you could play a lot of very consistent effects without using the same card twice.
But one of the reasons that we've been talking about alternate formats was actually that a listener sent me their own version of an alternate format. So this is the idea was that they really wanted some way for characters to sort of level up and to be able to use versions that aren't in your deck to upgrade characters. And so they were looking for some ideas on how to do this and whether they were approaching it in the right way. And the idea is that there's some way to take a character like Danny, and then you can pay gold or win a challenge or something, and you get to go look for another version of Danny from your collection and either swap her with the current version or put her behind and they gain the text from both and that kind of thing to create this sort of leveling up of characters. I was wondering if you guys had ever seen anything like that, or whether there's some way to make that work.
I have not seen something like that, but I think you could make it work. You know, what I would do actually is a slightly different approach to it. I would look at attachments and think of attachments as level up cards. And so rather than searching for a different version of the card and adding it as text, which I think could become confusing or very cumbersome. Quickly become, yeah, cumbersome and a little bit overpowered.
And requires you to have all of the cards in the game, too, if you want.
Yeah. Well,
on top of that, what's the better Renly? Like, which one do you start with? You know, which Danny do you start with? There's some better Dannys.
Well, the idea is if you gained all the text from the other Danny, then it wouldn't really matter which Danny you started with, right? If you gained all the icons and so on.
Yeah, some Dannys suck.
Yeah, so we were just talking about the Maester's Path and Rusted Maesters. That's essentially a Maester that's leveling up. And actually, Nate's concept for it, I recall in conversation or maybe it was an article somewhere, but the whole idea was that you had this Maester that became more powerful by going to Old Town and doing these things and getting these chains. In a very thematic way was the idea, and actually it became quite powerful how they all comboed together. But you could select 10 different attachments that didn't have the same sort of synergy, but nevertheless were quite strong. So, for example, you know, you have all of the core set ones that give different icons or Rusted Sword.
Rusted Sword, yeah.
Yeah. That could be quite fun, I think. And then that way everyone would know. You know, because the other thing, too, is not everyone, if it's a relatively new player, or even if it's not, I mean, just keeping track of all the different versions of every different card is a little bit tough.
It'd almost be fun to have a pool of 10 or 12 attachments in the center that both players could pull from, you know, whether it's paying gold or win a certain challenge and then pay a gold, and be able to pick one of those attachments, because then you would always know what the other opponent had available.
Oh yeah, that's a cool idea.
I actually do quite like that, the idea that you're pulling from the same sort of, what would you call them, talents or whatever computer games are using nowadays, or D&D is using nowadays.
I'm too old for all this.
Yeah, exactly. I'm stuck in like five editions ago for all of these things. But yeah, you have this common pool of things that can be chosen from, and some could even appear twice, you know, if they're good. And you could take both of them if you were the first one to level up. So would leveling be winning challenges with the character, or would it be some way of paying gold?
Yeah, win a challenge with that character and pay one gold to take an attachment from the communal pool and put it on that character.
I don't know how complex this person is looking to get, but you could build in different requirements for different types of attachments too. For example, like, you know, if you want a military challenge and use an effect to kill a character as part of that challenge, something that Stark would do, maybe you could get one type of card. Or if you want an intrigue or, you know, something, there could be different, kind of like how some of the organized play has different
achievements,
right?
You could go really crazy, play Hand of the King format, and then every time your deck won against people within this pool or whatever, you got experience, and you'd have set levels where your character would level up and then could pick one of those attachments to start off with.
So when they came to play with the gold. A benefit starting off, I think that's a little harsh. I think it has to be earned within the match.
Well, you're playing people the same level.
Oh, well, yeah, I suppose that would work.
Yeah. It's like the D&D or RPG version.
Exactly. It's cumulative, right? So as you play more games, you get more levels. You play about my level 5 deck versus your level 5 deck.
But I think it's what you were mentioning about having achievements might be a little technical, but the examples you were giving might work. Because you could easily, if we're making this a communal pile, put 3 stacks, a military, an intrigue, and a power stack. And heck, you could even randomize them so that they're not always the same or they're face down. And if you win a military challenge with a unique character, they get the top one from the military stack. And that's a fairly simple way to keep track of it, but it still represents that sort of building of power, and you can control it by which attachments you decide to put in the deck.
And it could be interesting in that people would value defense a little bit more. Like, Chud blocking wouldn't be – you'd actually want to win on defense, not – to stop them from getting the power, but to stop them from getting that attachment on their character.
Yeah, I think it would wind up with a very different game because you would spend more time, you know, dupes would be better.
Defending.
A little more time defending. You would probably run cards like Bodyguard in those decks to try and save your characters. Yep. But by now, yeah.
I kind of like what you said, Alex, about the hidden cards. I don't know that I would randomize it, but if you had, let's say, 3 different stacks, and then if you won, you could look at a stack and choose a card. And then that way, if the opponent hadn't looked at that stack, maybe you randomize it at the beginning. So there's a pool of like 12, and then each stack has 4. And then you don't know – you may know what's in the 12, but you don't know which is in which stack. Right. And then – so you could choose if you won, but each time you chose, you know, you weren't really sure what you'd be seeing. That'd be pretty fun. It would be almost like the kind of Civil War that we were talking about in terms of drawing from the same card pool. But then it would also be a little bit like drafting, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting combination.
Well, I was expecting us to take a different tack with that because of the way that he'd sort of phrased this about duping characters and looking for characters from the collection to get more abilities. But I really like the idea that this is spark design, and that may not be what he was looking for at all, but I think it was an interesting way to develop a variant.
Thanks for writing in.
I doubt we were helpful, but I hope we were entertaining.
Yeah.
I have another quick comment on alternate formats, though. I don't know if you guys...
For sure. Yeah.
So this isn't an officially sanctioned format in terms of being promoted as part of a release or box or anything like that, but the New York Meta did at one point experiment with its own alternate format where we took a core, so the core was legal for everyone, and then you could pick, I think it was a box for one house, and then 1 or 2 cycles. And we used, in that respect, we had a limited card pool, and so we used that limited card pool, but then everyone would be drawing from a different card pool. And we tried that out. We were thinking at the time, actually, it might be an interesting test case. That's right. Yeah, because the environment felt a bit stagnant. That was before they had instituted the restricted lists in the way that they've done it. I think there are only a few restricted cards at that time.
Yeah, this was before the big expansion in like FAQ 4.0 that added another 20 cards or so to it. I do remember this on the boards that came up.
Yes, yeah, and actually we found that it didn't help at all with the balance. I mean, really what happened was that some cards that used to be just kind of mediocre became extremely powerful, and the whole range of power shifted, but it didn't correct the issue.
Now, I do think it certainly would make you look at the card pool very, very differently, because you're thinking, well, you know, there's these two cards that I always like to use in this cycle, but it's with a bunch of other terrible Targ cards. Should I pick this other cycle instead? And, of course, the answer is, yeah, pick the Beyond the Narrow Sea cycle. You're playing Targ, you idiot. But it certainly makes you look at what the bad cards or what the overall picture for that cycle is, which is a way you don't generally look at card pools.
Yeah, I did this in Ottawa when I was first promoting the game here and I was trying to get new players in, because I thought it would be cheaper for them to buy, you know, one or two full sets instead of all the cards so they could build a competitive deck. But we ran into the exact same problem, Dan. People were saying, like, wow, Taste for Blood. I don't have any attachment removal in my deck because it's not in the sets I picked, period. Like, impossible. So a Taste for Blood basically could just win the game for people and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did, actually, John, is Taste for Blood with Barrick. And if you think Taste for Blood was hard, Barrick was very difficult to get rid of in that format.
Yes, yeah, that's what I did, too.
You basically have to allow all the deluxe cycles for that to work, then, to get a little more balance. But yeah, they're actually... I'm glad you brought this up, because I'd actually forgotten that I meant to mention a couple other alternate formats that have been tried through the last year or two, actually. We mentioned a 2v2 tournament that was being played in the UK. I think that wound up being pretty crazy. Decks could work in... I think they were limited by the same deck-building restrictions as if they were building one deck, so you couldn't have two copies of Valor in the combined plot decks and so on. But there were still...
Right, but they'd play things like a full shutdown round where the opponents would have to only attack with one character but could only attack
with
two.
Lead by Example and Desolate Passage, for instance, was a complete shutdown. Yeah. So the game clearly isn't intended to be played as a 2v2, but you do find very interesting and unexpected ways to completely break the game as well. I think Choke was also a popular theme because of how quickly it could get running.
Yep, and Burn, like one person playing Dragon Pit, the other person playing like a Stark Winter with the attachment that gave everyone -1, so that your opponent's characters would all be at -3 all the time.
Other alternate formats that I've heard of, there's the Bear and the Maiden Fair tournaments that were run at Batalla por el Muro. So they had invented a fairly intricate set of rules for that I think had worked quite well. Then there was also the No Restricted List tournament, which is technically an alternate rule set because it really does change the way you play. That was also in the UK this year. So I think people are experimenting with different formats, especially now in sort of the swan song period of Game of Thrones, for what kind of neat things you can do while you still have a lot of people to play it with.
For listeners, I just thought I'd throw this out here. On Skype, my name is Dark Nod. Feel free to add me on Skype anytime. I love answering questions. I love building decks. And I try to get to all the questions that people send me whenever possible. Now, some weeks I get one or two. Other weeks I get a ton. And this week was one of the ones where I got a ton. So I wasn't able to answer as many questions from people as I would like just because I just didn't have time. But since I didn't actually get to type and answer them, I'd like to ask you two and see how you would respond. So I won't use anyone's name because I haven't actually requested that I, you know, put these questions on the cast just to make them anonymous. But someone asked me, and I'll see what you guys think, if I thought that the 2.0 tourney would sell out the day it was released at Gen Con. Now, this came from a European person, and they're worried of the fact that they'll be basically sleeping when Gen Con opens up the ability to buy tickets for these tournaments. Do you think the 2.0 tournament will sell out the very day of? Because Conquest sold out in like 2 days, I think, last year.
I would expect it to go very quickly. I don't know if it'll be day of or not. And I suspect that FFG may try to accommodate. For example, I think 1 year in Gen Con, the tournament sold out. Maybe this was the Joust tournament, and they added a few tickets so that people could continue to buy in. But yeah, I would expect the tickets to go quite quickly.
I was going to mention the same thing. I think they're going to go quite quickly. I think they may well go the day of or within, within 30 hours. But they have learned over the last couple of years with some of their tournaments. I believe it was Netrunner where they added – they had 140 or something like that, and it sold out so quickly. They added another 60, and then those sold out, and I think they added another 20 as they were buying up space that they could use and reshuffling things. So it would not be out of the realm of possibility for them to have decided, okay, this Thrones tournament is going to be 100 players or whatever it is. We're going to put 60 of them on sale on day one, and then we're going to wait a couple days and put another 40. I would like them to do something like that. I think that would be better, but who knows?
Mm-hmm. Now, the one issue, of course, is product, right? Because everyone that's in this tournament has to have a box set. So they're going to be somewhat limited by the amount of product they can guarantee for this tournament.
I don't think that's going to be that limiting because they're definitely going to bring more than 100 boxes. And they're going to reserve a box when you reserve a ticket, the same way they did for Conquest. So as long as they have enough boxes that they can accommodate the space that they have at Gen Con, which is maximum of what, like 400 places in their total amount of space they can use at Gen Con, they're going to have more than 400 boxes. So I don't think that'll be a problem. Whether you can get three or not, though, that's a whole other question.
Yeah, I think, like Alex says, they're just going to pull from their inventory. And I would expect, though, that that will impact the inventory. In fact, I think it will be quite difficult to get a box unless you're there first thing in the morning waiting for the doors to open. You're probably not going to get a box for Thrones, would be my guess.
Unless you're in this tournament.
Unless you're in the tournament, yeah. So I mean, people who are willing to wait up and or show up early at the doors, wait for about an hour and then run into the FFG as the first thing, probably can get a box that way and then through the tournament. So you might have as many as two boxes, unless they allow you to buy multiple boxes, in which case you might have up to three, I would guess.
I think they allowed that for Conquest, and I think I think it might have been X-Wing or Netrunner that they didn't allow that. But, you know, they've run this a couple of times now. They've done these launch tournaments at Gen Con. They do know what they're doing, hopefully. And, you know, other things have been simplified too, like if you show up and there's a long line, you get a ticket that reserves the items that you want and you can show up later in the day and things like that. So I wouldn't imagine it to be quite as hectic as Dan is making it out to be. I also suspect they'll have more product than they've had for any of their previous launches as well, because they've mentioned at the Gamma picture that we were showing that they expect this to be their biggest marketing push and probably their biggest launch then. So I think they're going to have to take that into account.
That's the best point, is that they've done this now a couple times. The first time, you know, they had some kinks that worked out. The second time, a few kinks. Now should just be smooth sailing. So I have a message from a new player in the U.S. He says, "Hi, I'm a new player, less than a year." He says, "I know 2.0 is about to come out, but I couldn't help myself. I bought it anyways."
Good man.
So he says, "Yeah, good man." He says he's planning to go to both Worlds and Gen Con. He's extremely competitive, and he's having a great time. And he's heard of some of the big names from a Game of Thrones, like Jon Bruno, thanks to Beyond the Wall and 2C1C. But he's wondering who else he should be looking out for at Gen Con. What other names should he be scared of when he sits across from?
That's a tough one. I mean, I understand what he's asking, but I don't know if I really judge based on knowing the person I'm sitting across from. I mean, I didn't know Dave Stroms when I first sat across from him and played him, but I knew he'd won his last five games, and he was playing a house that's going to be a problem for me. It wouldn't have mattered if that was someone I didn't know, and I'm glad I met him and played that game, and it was an excellent game at that Gen Con. But I think once you're up beyond a win or two, you have to assume that the player across from you is as good as or better than you are. And there are a few that have some style and what kind of things you can maybe expect from them, whether they're going to lean to combo your decks. So if you're facing Greg Atkinson, you can expect his deck to be doing something very strange. And so you have to, you know, put the pieces together in your head or disrupt from unexpected angles. But the names don't really matter all that much.
I think I mostly agree with that, Alex, but I might suggest just a couple of quick additions. I mean, the really easy way to do this would just be to read all of the World Champion cards and just
go to the wiki.
Yeah, take note of those names. Not all of those players still play or are as good as they were when they won, but they're all still very smart, and those who play are quite competitive. And so whenever you're playing against a player like that, you have to be aware. I think, though, in terms of individuals, I agree with Alex. What I might say, though, is that it sometimes is helpful to know the meta, because certain metas have reputations or strengths, if you will. And, you know, just as an example, I think New York is known for their Targaryen players. And so if you're sitting down against a New York player and they're playing Targ, I mean, I guess that doesn't tell you a lot more information, but it may be helpful to know if you're playing against a New York player when you see the Targ house versus not, because we have a certain play style and particular cards that we like to use. The same thing is certainly true for Washington, D.C. area players.
High efficiency.
Yeah, extremely high efficiency. You're probably not going to see a ton of combos unless they're just good cards that happen to combo together. You're just going to see very highly efficient characters, very aggressive play style. You'll definitely see multi-claim plots. So, yeah, just knowing the meta, I think, can be a little bit helpful there.
That can also be somewhat hard to do, though. I mean, DC is not just people from DC. It's also people from Wisconsin and people from, I mean, it spreads fairly far. So someone might tell you that they're playing the DC deck and that therefore they're using that sort of high efficiency deck that you were describing. But I couldn't list all the players who might be doing so. I couldn't give you their names.
Right. And really, what is SoCal style? Something a little interesting, but that's good.
I don't know if SoCal as a unit has a style.
That's what I mean. Yeah, so I think it's very hard to answer that question because, you know, I hope the person that wrote this, they said they're very competitive. Well, I hope they make the cut. I hope that they're a very good player. And their name's not a name that they would know because they've been playing for less than a year and they haven't had the privilege to go to Gen Con, which is an awesome thing. And I hope when you're there, you come by and see me and Alex and we have a beer together. But I would have to agree with Alex. I don't think the names matter as much as where you are in the standings. If you're 4-0 or 5-0, you're playing a good player.
The so names can matter for bragging rights, though. Afterwards, you're at the bar and you say, you know, I beat Darknage and I slaughtered him. And
sure.
And now that he's over there in tears, that was me. And
it was kind of cruel to tease me like that, though.
Well,
I have a follow-up question that is related, though. If you think about the top, let's say, 32 people who break, or 16, or however many it is for a tournament, what proportion do you expect to be people who are familiar and known as being competitive?
Half.
I would have said two-thirds.
Yeah,
maybe two-thirds, yeah.
Yeah, I think probably close to two-thirds. I mean, if of 32, I think probably 20 to 25 would be people who you'd know, and then there'd be another maybe 10 who are just people who are quite good but less known.
Yeah, but that's a matter of experience. You know, a player that could be amazing that's only been in here for 6 months, it's going to be much harder for him to be competitive than someone that's been playing for 4 years. It's just number of games, right? So someone has all these natural abilities now because they've played a billion games to make quick calculations, to choose the right plots. They know your deck a little bit more just from experience. So even though the player could be
highly skilled. So we're not good, we're just old?
Yeah. Well, that's true. An old hat will have an advantage in this game of a huge card pool of 1,500 unique cards or whatever it is.
No, it's almost 2,000. It might even be slightly more than 2,000
great.
Now.
More.
You know, Alex.
Cement my point.
Alex, the statistics that you track as part of the spreadsheets that you have, I'm drawing a blank on the name.
The annals. The annals.
Yes, thank you. Right. Yeah, that's a fantastic resource for deck information. I wonder, have you ever considered adding in player names?
Yes, and sometimes player names do go into there. I do have some reservations of this for a couple of reasons, and so this was brought up on CardGameDB. Roughly after the first update of this of the annals, and this was the idea that I didn't want it to become a wall of shame either, where you were listing players who didn't make the cut.
Yeah, everyone has bad or good days. I mean, it happens.
So I wouldn't be opposed to it only existing for the cut, but I think that's one more piece of data that I'm asking for TOs that I don't think I can reliably get.
Yeah, and that tends to be somewhat time intensive in inserting, as you say, because it's not an automatic data point. It's something you have to type out.
That said, if the new tourney software that they're talking about for things like Thrones 2.0 has some way that I can access the data, which is what I'm really hoping it does, that you can submit a form that has the final standings, then maybe it will be much easier for me to just pick.
All right, let's move on to our next question here. This one's got your name all over it, Dan. So it says, Tarek seems to be in a bad spot these days, other than a no agenda list based on Danny and Pri. Is there any other T1 Tarek builds, Dan?
You know, Tarek is an interesting house that always feels like the underdog, except when it's wrecking house. And I think that the interesting thing about Tarek, if you look back ever since the LCG, you know, the transition occurred, Tarek has been weak with moments of just extreme strength. So I think, for example, the first very powerful Tarek deck that seemed to be meta-defining was probably the Tarek Wildlings deck. That deck was an answer to an aggro-heavy meta, in particular all of the Wildlings and all of the other decks, and then Lannister with Neil and aggro characters. So, and then the second moment I think it became strong was a Tarek Maester Burn deck, similar to what I played when I topped four at Gen Con, which was Worlds with the Maesters. And then the third one, I think, was Tarek Rusted Maester, maybe a year or two later.
Wasn't Hollow Hill before Rusted Maester?
Am I getting my order confused?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know the Rusted Maester could have been built, but it couldn't because of the Marine Fighting Pits, which didn't release until after we had some Hollow Hill. I think Rusted Maesters was 2013, and Bruno won with Tarek Hollow Hill in 2012.
Okay. Yeah, so there was Tarek Hollow Hill, and then there was another iteration of Tarek Hollow Hill that... Yeah.
Well, it was better with all the restricted cards, so no, it wasn't necessarily better, but it was just more refined at that point.
That's right, yeah, and played Dry Season. That was Dave Strum's deck.
Yeah.
And then most recently, Tarek Heir to the Iron Throne, or really just, you could call it the Dany deck, that leverages Dany to just level the opponent's board. But in each case, if you look at the trends, it's really building up to that moment. Tarek is not perceived as a threat, or it feels like the underdog, and then somebody comes up with a recipe, typically in an environment where there's a lot of aggro, and then just finds a way to crush those decks. And so if you think of the environment as kind of a rock, paper, scissors environment, frequently there's the rock and the paper, and then Tarek comes in as the scissors and just manages to read the metagame well. So I tend to think of a Tarek deck as, first, somewhat difficult a lot of times to build for that reason, and second, as a strong metagame choice in particular environments. And to the extent that the question you posed, John, acknowledges Tarek as the current underdog, I think we will see a shift away from Tarek, and then there is a potential for Tarek to be the disruptor here and just emerge in kind of an unexpected way. I mean, if you think about the environment, it's very aggro-heavy right now. There are some strong control builds, but Alufin Apar is driving this aggro build, and then also Lannister, which tends to be more of an aggro build, is, you know, whether it's Neil or kind of the clansmen approach, is quite aggressive, and so Tarek is traditionally pretty good against Lannister. There are probably two different things that make it a little bit harder for Tarek at the moment right now. First is cancel. Tarek generally relies on high-impact effects or a combination of effects. Even if you think about Burn, it's really just a combo. Usually you have two or three cards, and one of them may be kind of a static, like Dragon Pit, -1 to everything. But then you're stacking that up with a Dragon Knight and an Incinerate, or a Hatchling Feast and an Incinerate or something. So it's two or three cards to actually burn a character, typically. So it's usually easier to disrupt just one of those pieces, and so Tarek's particularly vulnerable to that kind of cancel or disruption. And there's a lot of that in the environment with Harrenhal and the Iron Throne. And then the other thing is that Greyjoy, which is, I think, traditionally been a good matchup for Tarek, has become quite resilient to Tarek Burn. in large part, given some of the tools it has for soft location removal. I'm thinking like the characters that you discard a card to kneel. So to kneel a location. So Gordon, is it Gordon Goodbrother?
It's one of the Goodbrothers, yeah.
Yeah. And then the Westerlings is another good example out of Lannister. And so, and since Lannister was typically, or traditionally, a little bit easier for Targ to deal with, that becoming a harder matchup doesn't help Targ very much in the metagame. So, on one hand, I feel like there could be a Targ deck that emerges, and that'll take people by surprise. On the other hand, they're facing some harder challenges this year that go beyond just your typical metagame. And then just to add on top of that, aloof and apart means that the opponent's characters typically are a little bit bigger than they were in the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm actually going to disagree a little bit with Dan, which disagreeing with Dan about Targ is probably a sign that I'm wrong. First of all, I'm sad that you mentioned all those powerful decks and you didn't mention the Black Sails. I'm hurt.
Especially well, that's just a Dany deck. Yeah, that's a good that's it's just a another great deck, Dany but it's deck. Another Dany deck, yeah.
And they asked specifically not for Dany or Pipe, right?
Okay.
Deck based on those.
I think you're entirely right about Targ up to a certain point where the meta had to be right for it because it had certain very defined weaknesses and the Targ Wild or the Wildlings came out and the Maesters came out and those were exploiting a niche within the meta and that made them very much meta calls. I think that somewhat changed when we hit Beyond the Narrow Sea cycle. And I mentioned that earlier, but Beyond the Narrow Sea had Meraxes, Marine Tourney Grounds, Incinerates, Young Griff, Strong Bellus, the Great Pyramid, Company of the Cat, Long Lances, the Fighting Pits. There were so many. I mean, that's most of Targ right now. And I think that shored up so many weaknesses, like Meraxes, for instance, being an excellent example, that I think it became less niche to use Targ. Now, I think that's still true to some extent because we're relying on Burn and now we're stronger characters, and there always will be. But I think the order of magnitude has changed. And it used to be that Targ was unplayable until it became amazing, and now it's on the lower end of the curve until it rises. I think that it's more stable now than it was then.
So, see, you guys did a much better answer than I would have, because I would have responded and said, Targ's in a hard place. But I think there's a couple lists that are still Tier 1 outside of Dany and Priapri, like Rusted Maesters. And that was really enforced while I was having a Facebook chat, actually, with Dan and Buzz, who, when he asked, he said, is there really a T1 build outside of Rusted Maesters for Targ? So the fact that two different people asked that same type of question, but with a different build, tells me that there's at least two. There's the Dany Priapri, No Agenda list, and the Rusted Maesters at a minimum.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I would say that more than perhaps other houses, Targ relies on the element of surprise. The fact that there may be commonly accepted Tier 1 builds that are... Yeah, that gives it a higher disadvantage than it would another house, I think. Unless it's...
Yeah.
The one maybe wild card I would say here is that Targ has some relatively new effects that are extremely powerful and I think probably somewhat underrated or not understood. I'm thinking probably first and foremost would be by Sword or by Guile, which is one of my favorite underrated cards. It's just extremely high impact. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, it's a it's at least six a six power swing. Yeah, and if it's unopposed, that's seven power. So on a Valor round, for example, and I frequently get that off when I'm playing by Sword or by Guile. That can mean the difference between losing a game and getting a modified win or loss, which in a competitive setting is quite important.
Well, here's the last question that I got this week that I didn't answer. And again, I apologize for not writing back because I do try to write back. So this is a newer player as well, 2 years. They say, my meta is filled with these super strong Maester decks. Without running bad cards, how can I deal with these Maesters?
The two cards that come to mind are Harrenhal and Cold Hands. And they're both great cards, and they both work very well together. Cold Hands just wrecks Maester decks. It's one of the reasons I don't like playing Maesters much.
And Mira.
But yeah, Mira is another good example.
Yeah, I like, you know, a lot of people are saying if you don't have a house-specific answer, you can run Taken Captive and then either Aftermath or March to the Wall. Does that actually work with March to the Wall, Alex? If I, you know, Taken Captive the Maester with all the chains, and then can I select that Maester from March because of the order of passive versus when revealed effects?
No, you can't. So the character will return as soon as you reveal a new plot, but before when reveals happen.
No, Taken Captive allows you to take control after you reveal a new plot.
Oh, no, actually, no, that wouldn't work either, sorry. Because Taken Captive will only trigger after the one reveals, and it will cease before the one reveals.
Oh, I thought passives would take effect before the one revealed.
No, when reveals happen before passives. So the when reveals of your marched would happen, and then Taken Captive, because it's been placed in the use pile, would trigger. And then on the turn after that, where you might potentially want to use it, the expiry of the Taken Captive happens before the one revealed, because it's not a passive, it's a conditional constant. So, very
tricky
timing. Oh, that's
great. So only Aftermath would work, though, obviously, because you would take control and then discard during immersion.
Yes, that certainly would work. But then there are other options as well for dealing with a problem character. Mel's Favor is still a phenomenal answer if you're playing Bera.
Well, you can't kill it, though.
Just taking it for a round. Well, and you can't kill it to Harrenhal, but you can still let it die to claim.
True enough.
Yeah, I think pretty much every house has some sort of answer to Maesters. In Martell, it's, you know, Gaston Grey is still a really good answer.
Yep. Bastard, you can play in any Black Sails deck, and one of a Bastard is worthwhile in the Black Sails.
Yeah, but I think generically Cold Hands is my favorite. I mean, unless they have a dupe or a cancel, Cold Hands just ruins their day.
Cold Hands plus Harrenhal, doesn't matter if they have a dupe.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm with you there. All right, those were the questions I had for this week.
John, closing comments. I was looking at a couple of the tournaments coming up, but it looks like the big ones that we've been asked to plug aren't till the start of May. So I don't have much. Do we have a snappy sign-off?
I don't have anything either, and it's your turn for the snappy sign-off, Alex.
I'll think of one. And if I really think of a good one, I'll edit it in. Or not.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.